for 30 minutes. In Silicon Valley, an outage is one of the biggest debacles a company can face. But instead of criticizing Ben, our lead engineer announced we should deliberately trigger failures more often, although preferably in ways that don't crash the site. He christened this practice Ben testing, and we hired Ben full-time. Facebook is a relatively young company, so our management team goes on a yearly visit to an organization with staying power. We've been to Pixar, Samsung, Procter & Gamble, Walmart, and the Marine Corps base Quantico. At Quantico, we went through basic training. To get a taste of the experience, we ran at night with our gear while officers shouted at us. The shouting continued as we performed smaller tasks like making beds and turning faucets on and off with military precision. The next day, in teams of four, we had to move heavy bags over a wall without letting them touch the ground. This was challenging for tech types, who are more used to loading digital documents than loading cargo. Very few of our teams completed any of the tasks. I wasn't surprised that I failed at the physical challenges. What I didn't expect was that I would fail at following a command to turn off a faucet. Before Quantico, I never would have run a full debrief after an obviously disastrous performance. When things went wrong at work, it was important to me that the people responsible for the mistake acknowledge it. But once they did, sitting down together to discuss in excruciating detail how and why the mistake was made just seemed like piling on. I also worried that this level of scrutiny might discourage risk-taking. I was surprised that after every mission, and even after every training session, the Marines do formal debriefs. Then they record the lessons learned in a repository so that everyone can access them. The Marines taught me the importance of creating a culture where failure is seen as a learning opportunity. When done insensitively, debriefs feel like public flagellation, but when expected and required, they no longer feel personal. In hospitals, where decisions have life and death consequences, healthcare professionals hold morbidity and mortality conferences. The purpose of M&Ms is to review the cases of patients where something went seriously wrong and figure out how to prevent similar problems in the future. The mistakes can range from a complication during surgery to an incorrect dose of a drug to a misdiagnosis of a disease. The discussions are confidential, and evidence shows they can lead to improvements in patient care. When it's safe to talk about mistakes, people are more likely to report errors and less likely to make them. Yet typical work cultures showcase successes and hide failures. Just look at any resume. I have never seen one with a section called Things I Do Poorly. Scientist Melanie Steffen wrote an article challenging her peers to be more honest in their CVs. Princeton professor Johannes Haushofer took her up on it and posted his failure resume, a list that went on for 2 pages of rejections from degree programs, job openings, academic journals, fellowships, and scholarships. He later noted, "This darn CV of failures has received way more attention than my entire body of academic work." Convincing people to be more open about failure is not easy. Kim Malone Scott, who worked with me at Google, used to bring a stuffed monkey named Whoops to her team's weekly meetings. She would ask colleagues to share mistakes from that week, and then they'd all vote for the biggest screw-up. The winner got to keep the stuffed monkey on their desk where everyone could see it until the next week when someone else earned the honor. Nothing could have been a better reminder to try hard things and discuss failures openly. Probably the only member of the team who didn't feel good about this exercise was Whoops, who never got a week off from being the symbol of imperfection. Working with small businesses at Facebook has shown me that resilience is needed in organizations of all sizes. Damon Redd started the outdoor clothing company Kind Design out of his basement in Colorado. When a flood filled his home with 5 feet of muddy water, he lost his designs, computers, and thousands of pieces of merchandise. He wasn't in a flood zone, so he didn't have insurance to cover the loss. In an inventive effort to salvage damaged gloves, Damon power washed and dried them, then started advertising them as flood gloves. He posted about how the gloves and other products like hats, shirts, and hoodies symbolized the durability of the people of Colorado and his brand. His posts went viral, and he racked up sales in all 50 states, saving his business. Teams that focus on learning from failure outperform those that don't, but not everyone works in an organization that takes the long view. When that's the case, we can try to find our own ways to learn. When Adam was in graduate school, he was terrified of public speaking. After his first interview for a teaching job, he was told that he would never make it in the classroom because he wouldn't command enough respect from hard-nosed business school students. Professors are rarely taught how to teach, so to practice and improve, Adam volunteered to give guest lectures in other people's classes. These were tough audiences. Instead of a whole semester to build relationships, he had only an hour to win over students. At the end of every guest lecture, Adam handed out feedback forms, asking how he could be more engaging and effective. The comments were not fun to read. Some students reported that Adam seemed so nervous that he made them physically shake in their seats. After these sweat-soaked guest lectures, Adam started teaching his own class. A few weeks into the course, he asked the students to write anonymous feedback. Then he did something several colleagues called insane. He emailed the full set of comments to the entire class. Another professor warned Adam that doing this would be like dumping fuel on a fire. But one of Adam's colleagues, Sue Ashford, had taught him that gathering and acting on negative feedback is how you reach your potential. Sue's studies show that although fishing for compliments hurts your reputation, asking for criticism signals that you care about improving. Adam opened the next class with an analysis of the major themes in his students' comments. Next, he shared how he would act on their feedback, like telling personal stories more often to bring concepts to life. Students were able to shape their own learning, and the class culture changed so that Adam was learning from them. A few years later, Adam became Wharton's top-rated professor. Each semester, he continues to ask students for feedback, then shares their comments openly and makes changes to his teaching approach. We all have blind spots. Weaknesses that other people see, but we don't. Sometimes we're in denial. Other times, we simply don't know what we're doing wrong. The people who have taught me the most in my career are the ones who pointed out what I didn't see. At Google, my colleague Joan Brady explained that I wasn't as persuasive as I could be in meetings because I often jumped in to speak early. She said that if I could be more patient and let others express their views first, I could make my arguments better by addressing their concerns. David Fisher, who runs our global teams at Facebook, often reminds me that I need to slow down and listen more. Sometimes feedback is hard to take. About 4 months after I lost Dave, I got a call from his poker buddy, Chamath Palihapitiya, who used to work with me at Facebook. Chamath said he was coming over to take me for a walk. So I put on my collar and started pacing around near my front door. Okay, not quite, but I was excited to see him. I expected Chamath to check in on how my daughter and son and I were doing, but he surprised me by saying that he wanted to make sure I was still pushing myself at work. I looked at him in shock, and admittedly some anger. You want me to do more? Are you kidding me? I explained that it was all I could do just to get through each day without messing up too much. Chamath rejected that completely. He said that I could yell at him all I wanted, but he would always be there to remind me that I still needed to set ambitious goals. He advised me, as only Chamath could, to get back on the mother effing path. Challenging someone like this could easily backfire. But Chamath knew me well enough to recognize that his blunt encouragement would provide a needed jolt of confidence and remind me that I could fail by failing to try. He also inspired the only paragraph in this book that uses the F word. One of the best ways to see ourselves clearly is to ask others to hold up a mirror. Top athletes and singers have coaches, surgeon and author Atul Gawande reflects. Should you? In basketball, Greg Popovich has coached the San Antonio Spurs to 5 NBA championships. After losing in the finals one year, he sat down with the team to review every single play of the previous two games and learn what they did wrong. The measure of who we are is how we react to something that doesn't go our way, he said. There are always things you can do better. It's a game of mistakes. Sports teams are recognizing the importance of looking for players who can learn from failure. In 2016, the Chicago Cubs won the World Series after a 108-year drought. General manager Theo Epstein explained why. We will always spend more than half the time talking about the person rather than the player. We would ask our scouts to provide three detailed examples of how these young players faced adversity on the field and responded to it, and three examples of how they faced adversity off the field. Because baseball is built on failure. The old expression is that even the best hitter fails 7 out of 10 times. In sports, taking suggestions from a coach is the whole point of practice. Adam traces his openness to feedback to his past as a junior Olympic diver. Criticism was the only way to get better. When it was time for Adam to enter the classroom, he ditched the Speedo but kept the strategy. He turned his students into his coaches. Accepting feedback is easier when you don't take it personally. Being open to criticism means you get even more feedback, which makes you better. One way to lessen the sting of criticism is to evaluate how well you handle it. After every low score you receive, law professors Doug Stone and Sheila Heen advise, you should give yourself a second score based on how you handle the first score. Even when you get an F for the situation itself, you can still earn an A+ for how you deal with it. The ability to listen to feedback is a sign of resilience. And some of those who do it best gained that strength in the hardest way possible. I met Byron Ogiest when I was an associate at McKinsey and we were assigned to work on the same project. The first African-American director in the company's history, Byron had a calmness that allowed him to see feedback as, in his words, purely anthropological. He later told me that this attitude comes in part from the trauma he suffered as a teenager. When Byron was 15, he was walking to dinner with his cousin, younger brother, and dad near their home in Phoenix. Out of nowhere, a drunk driver plowed into the group, breaking both of Byron's legs. When he woke up in the hospital, his mother had to tell him the horrible news that his father was in a coma and his 10-year-old brother had died. After the accident, Byron vowed not to become a problem for his grieving parents. He excelled in school all the way through earning a PhD in economics. What helped him build resilience the most, he told me, was overcoming pervasiveness. Extreme compartmentalization may be my biggest superpower, he said, laughing. If a project doesn't turn out the way he wanted, Byron remembers that things could always be worse. I say to myself and to others all the time, is anyone going to die? That's the worst. I'm not afraid of failure. Byron showed me that building resilient teams and organizations takes open and honest communication. When companies fail, it's usually for reasons that almost everyone knows, but almost no one has voiced. When someone isn't making good decisions, few have the guts to tell that person, especially if that person is the boss. One of my favorite posters on our office walls reads, "Nothing at Facebook is someone else's problem." In a company-wide meeting, I asked everyone facing challenges in working with a colleague, which is, of course, everyone, to speak more honestly to that person. I set a goal that we would all have at least one hard conversation each month. To help the conversations go well, I reminded everyone that feedback should always go both ways. I talked about how a single sentence can make people more open to negative feedback. I'm giving you these comments because I have very high expectations and I know that you can reach them. Now, when I visit our offices around the world, I ask each team, who has had at least one hard conversation in the past month? At first, very few hands went up. And let's face it, when I'm standing in front of them, my colleagues are more likely to over-report than under-report. As I've persisted, I've seen more and more hands go up, and some of our leaders have taken bold steps to make openness to feedback part of our culture. Carolyn Everson, who runs our global sales teams, shares her performance reviews in an internal Facebook group with 2,400 members. She wants her entire team to see how she's working to improve. As my year of firsts came to a close, I started thinking about one more hard conversation. A big one. Each year, I host a Leadership Day for Women at Facebook. The previous year, I shared stories about my professional and personal fears and failures. I talked about times in my life that I felt truly unsure of who I was. I admitted to having made many bad decisions, including getting married and divorced in my early 20s, and then going on to date a few wrong men. Then I talked about ending up in a true partnership with Dave. That year, my conclusion was, believing it will all work out helps it all work out. A year later, I was in a very different place. I also had a heightened awareness that others in the room were struggling too. One coworker's mother was terminally ill. Another coworker was going through a difficult divorce. And those were just the two I knew about. I was sure that many were suffering in silence as we often do at work. I decided to open up in the hope that it might help others with hardships in their lives. I spoke about the three P's and what deep grief felt like. I admitted that I had not understood how hard it was to be a single parent or to stay focused at work when you're struggling at home. I was worried that I wouldn't get through the speech without crying, and I didn't. Still, by the end, I felt a sense of relief. In the weeks that followed, others at work started opening up as well. Together, we sent a bunch of elephants stampeding right out of our building. One of the women in the room that day was Karen Maroney. I knew Karen had a big decision to make since we had recently offered her a promotion to run our global communications team. But that decision had become far more complicated. Karen's doctor had just told her that she might have breast cancer. She was waiting for test results, but had already made up her mind that if her diagnosis was positive, she would not accept the promotion. The combo of being afraid of failing in a new job and then being told you might have cancer was overwhelming, she told me. Karen didn't feel comfortable discussing her medical issues at work. She didn't want to burden anyone and was afraid of appearing weak. But after hearing me open up about my struggles in front of thousands of coworkers, she saw a glimmer of possibility. The next week, Karen's doctor confirmed that she had cancer and would require surgery and ongoing treatment. I asked her what she wanted to do about work and assured her that she had our full support no matter what she decided. She told me that meeting other patients made her realize how lucky she was that her cancer was caught at an early stage and that she worked for a company that gave her so much flexibility. She said she was scared, but did not want to give up a role she'd been working toward for so many years. Together, we laid out a plan for her to take the new job. I had to jettison the notion of being a fearless leader, Karen said. Instead, the first time she addressed the 200-person global communications team, she spoke openly about her diagnosis. She was undergoing daily radiation treatments, which were physically draining and made her forgetful. In any version of picturing this moment, that fantasy of what you want to be, I would have been strong, smart, and inspiring confidence, she told me. I wanted to be a role model in that perfect, put-together sense. Instead, I told them I had cancer and would need their support. Their response blew her away. Karen's teammates pulled together to help and started sharing more of their own personal and professional challenges. Karen believes that this openness made their work more efficient. You'd think sharing would slow you down, but it takes time and energy to hide things, Karen said. Being more open personally led people to be more open professionally. Karen's team used to discuss lessons learned in one-on-one meetings, but most people were not comfortable discussing failure in larger groups. Lessons learned is now something that the full team has embraced. Before, we used to talk about what went well, Karen said. Now we cover what went wrong, too. Karen powered through her own year of firsts. She has led the global communications team and made it through radiation. On her first day of treatment, I gave her a necklace with the letters YGT. She was confused at first, since her initials are CLM. I explained that it was a symbol of my faith in her and stood for, "You've got this." I now say YGT to my team all the time, Karen said, and they say it to each other. YGT. It means so much. Chapter 10. To Love and Laugh Again. At the time of our wedding in 2004, Dave was working at Yahoo and I was working at Google. We thought one way of handling the rivalry between our companies and some of our wedding guests was to make a joke of it by giving everyone a choice of baseball hats. It would be our version of, "Are you with the bride or the groom?" I ordered the Google hats way in advance and was feeling pretty good about them until Dave took one of my hats to the Yahoo office and said, "Make ours nicer." They did, and to the delight of the Yahoo team, many of the Google guests wore Yahoo hats all weekend. Love and laughter were always intertwined for Dave and me, and we wanted our wedding to reflect that. At my bridal brunch, I gave all my girlfriends a Mr. Wonderful doll. When you squeeze the doll's hand, it spoke, saying things like, "Let's just cuddle tonight," or, "Aw, can't your mother stay another week?" My favorite was, "You take the remote. As long as I'm with you, I don't care what we watch." At our rehearsal dinner, my brother-in-law Mark took humor to a whole new level, narrating a slideshow of me and my past boyfriends. And yes, the phrase, "dude with a nipple ring," did come up. Our wedding took place on a beautiful and extremely breezy Arizona day. Right before the ceremony, Dave and I gathered in a small room with our family and closest friends to sign the vows we'd written as part of our ketubah, the Jewish wedding contract. I signed first, then Dave added his bold, messy signature. We headed outdoors, where an aisle had been laid on an open lawn. The procession began, and just as I stepped into place, I heard Mark ahead of me egging on our 3-year-old ring bearer. "Hey, Jasper, I've heard this wedding is pants optional." My sister jumped in. "Jasper, no more spit bombs." I started down the makeshift aisle, still laughing from the Jasper exchange, when a gust of wind blew my veil so far up in the air that I almost fell over. I stabilized, joined Dave, and the rabbi began. Traditionally, a Jewish bride circles her groom 7 times. Dave and I circled each other, our eyes locked. Our friends said it looked like we were dancing. Then, surrounded by our parents and siblings, we faced each other and paragraph by paragraph, recited the vows we'd written together. "I take you to be mine in love. I promise to love you deliberately each day, to feel your joy and your sorrow as my own. Together, we will build a home filled with honor and honesty, comfort and compassion, learning and love. I take you to be mine in friendship. I vow to celebrate all that you are, to help you become the person you aspire to be. From this day forward, your dreams are my dreams, and I dedicate myself to helping you fulfill the promise of your life. I take you to be mine in faith. I believe that our commitment to each other will last a lifetime, that with you, my soul is complete. Knowing who I am and who I want to be, on this day of our marriage, I give you my heart to be forever united with yours. We spent 11 years living these vows, circling each other in love and friendship. Then, suddenly, Dave's forever was over. Each night, my broken-hearted march to bed included seeing our vows as I walked past Arkituba hanging on the bedroom wall near Dave's closet. The sight of both pained me, especially his clothes, which hung there as if waiting for him to come home, as I was. After several months, I was still holding my breath as I walked past this wall and realized that I needed to do something. I could not bear to take Arkituba down. It hangs there still. So I decided to clean out Dave's closet. It's impossible to describe how much I dreaded this task. Nothing prepares you for this. Carol Geithner advised me to include my son and daughter, and the three of us started together. We laughed, which shocked me, at the pile of almost identical gray sweaters and shirts from conferences that Dave had attended decades before. We cried when we pulled out his beloved Vikings jersey. My kids selected what they wanted to keep, and as my daughter hugged one of his sweaters, she blurted out what we'd all been thinking. "The clothes smell like Daddy." Later that night, Dave's mother Paula and his brother Rob came upstairs to help me finish. They had already performed this miserable task once when they cleaned out Dave's father's closet 16 years earlier. They never thought they would be doing this for Dave, and the completely surreal feeling overwhelmed all three of us. Paula held up the frayed gray sweater Dave wore most often, and I broke down completely. I turned to her and said, "I can't believe you are going through this again. How are you okay? How can you possibly be okay?" She said, "I didn't die. Mel did, and Dave did. But I am alive, and I am going to live." She put her arm around me and said, "And you are going to live too." Then she completely stunned me by adding, "And you are not only going to live, but you are going to get remarried one day, and I am going to be there to celebrate with you." Until then, I had not thought about finding love again. Months earlier, I had mentioned to Rob that I was going to take down the photograph of a beach at night that hung in my bedroom. Dave and I had selected the photograph together, but now its dark imagery felt too depressing. I told Rob I wanted to replace it with a picture of me, Dave, and our kids. Rob shook his head. "This is your bedroom," he said. "No pictures of Dave. You're going to move on." Moving on is easier said than done. I couldn't bear to take off my wedding ring, but every time I saw it on my left hand, I felt I was living in denial. I moved the ring to my right hand so I could still feel connected to Dave, but wasn't pretending that I was still married. Since I couldn't even sort out my feelings for an inanimate object, I really couldn't bring myself to consider the possibility of dating, let alone talk about it. It felt disloyal and just reminded me how much I wanted Dave back. So when Rob implied that there might be someone else in my life one day, I quickly changed the subject. At the same time, I had never wanted to be alone. My parents have a very loving marriage, and since childhood, I longed to have one too. I think that this led me to get married too young the first time. I know that a stronger sense of independence and the confidence that I could take care of myself would have helped me throughout my dating life. After my first marriage ended in divorce, I had a repetitive stress dream where I would wake up looking for someone who was supposed to be sleeping next to me, see the empty bed, and realize that I was alone. After I married Dave, the dream still happened, but then I would wake up to see him next to me, or more frequently hear him snoring next to me, and feel that, oh, I was just dreaming, relief. Now the stress dream was real. I was alone in my bed. alone when my kids went on playdates. Just 1 hour in my house without them made me project into the future to when they would go off to college, leaving me behind. Would I be alone for the rest of my life? Marnie reminded me that being alone can be an empowering choice. In a landmark 15-year study of changes in marital status among more than 24,000 people, getting married increased average happiness only a little bit. On a scale of 0 to 10, single people who were at a 6.7 in happiness might increase to a 6.8 after getting married. That tiny boost occurred around the time of the wedding and typically faded within a year. If one of the participants lost a spouse and did not remarry, 8 years later on average, their happiness would be a 6.55. It turns out that people who choose to be single are very satisfied with their lives. Singles are stereotyped, stigmatized, and ignored, psychologist Bella DiPaolo finds, and still live happily ever after. She asks us to imagine a world where married people are treated like singles. When you tell people you are married, they tilt their heads and say things like, "Aww," or, "Don't worry, honey, your turn to divorce will come." At work, the single people just assume that you can cover the holidays and all the other inconvenient assignments. Like all couples, Dave and I had moments when we were out of sync, but we always tried to address the issue head on. One thing we never addressed was the situation I now found myself in. I had told Dave that if I died, I wanted him to find love again, as long as he did not marry a woman who would be an evil stepmother and force our children to wear coats made from Dalmatians. Dave said it was an awful conversation and never shared a single wish with me. Now I encourage my friends and family to express their fears and desires to their partners. Love is the third rail of grief, a topic so charged that it is untouchable. After losing a partner, the only thing more emotionally fraught than finding joy is finding love. The mere thought of dating someone else triggers sadness followed by guilt. If just dancing with a childhood friend could make me burst into tears, imagine. How soon is too soon to date? I heard about a woman in England who lost her husband and began dating his best friend 4 weeks later. People were shocked at how quickly her new romance started. Her mother-in-law cut off communication with her, and many of her friends did too. "Blame me if you like," the woman said. "But grief hits people in different ways, and I have no regrets." When you are widowed, people pity you and want your sorrow to end. But if you start dating, sometimes they judge you and think maybe your sorrow ended just a wee bit too soon. A childhood friend of mine who is now a rabbi told me that in the Jewish religion, mourning for a parent, child, or sibling is a year, but mourning for a spouse is just 30 days. "The rabbis wanted people to move forward," he said. About 4 months into my widowhood, my brother David said there was something he wanted to talk to me about. "I don't know if it's okay to mention this," he said, sounding much more hesitant than he usually does. "But I think you should start thinking about dating." Like Rob, he assured me that Dave would never have wanted me to be alone. David believed it would help distract me and make me feel better about my future. He also pointed out that if I were a man, I would have started dating already. Sure enough, after a partner dies, men are more likely to date than women, and they start dating sooner. Of middle-aged adults who lost a spouse, 54% of men were in a romantic relationship a year later, compared with only 7% of women. Among older adults who lost a spouse, 15% of men were dating after 6 months, compared with less than 1% of women. And after 2 years, 25% of men had remarried, compared with just 5% of women. Men who start new relationships are judged less harshly. Women are expected to carry the torch of love, and when that flame is extinguished, they are supposed to mourn for it longer. The weeping widow lives up to our expectations. The widow who dances and dates does not. These differences reflect a double standard rooted in a range of issues, from women feeling more guilt and anxiety about new romances, to a greater cultural acceptance of men marrying younger women, to the demographic reality of women living longer than men. One practical matter that falls more heavily on women is the responsibility to care for children and aging parents. A colleague of mine told me about her extended family, which includes four single moms, and not one ever dated, let alone remarried. "I'm sure there are lots of reasons," she said, "but the one that they would all point to was that they didn't have the time or the money to date while raising their children." Most of her relatives had to work multiple jobs to support their families since the men didn't pay child support. The women absolutely wanted to find romantic love again, but it took all of their strength just to keep a roof over their children's heads. They couldn't afford babysitters and lived far from family or friends who could have pitched in to help. For them, dating was a luxury they could not afford. Widows continue to face cruel treatment around the world. In some parts of India, widows are cast away by their own families, left to beg to survive. In some Nigerian villages, widows are stripped naked and forced to drink water that has been used to bathe their dead husbands. Discrimination against widows has been observed by 54% of people in China, 70% in Turkey, and 81% in South Korea. In many countries, widows have difficulty obtaining property rights. Since there are few things that motivate me more than telling me that something is sexist, after my brother spoke up, I started thinking about dating. As I tried to wrap my head around it, the questions swirled. Would trying to move on just make it all worse? Would dating be as dreadful as it had been before? I started occasionally writing about dating in my journals. But when I shared entries with my closest friends and family, which I did when it was easier than talking about my feelings, I edited these parts out. I felt guilty even thinking about it and worried about their reactions. Several months later, I told Phil that I'd been emailing with a friend, and it was starting to feel almost flirty. Phil's initial reaction confirmed my fears. "I am your friend always," he said. "But Dave was my close friend. I'm not ready for this." Phil's aunt, who had lost her husband a year earlier, was with us. Later that day when they were alone, Phil told her that he thought he had done a pretty good job at handling an awkward conversation. His aunt replied, "You were awful." Phil was taken aback. At first, he defended his position, explaining to her, "I was following the guy code. I was trying to respect Dave, not judge Cheryl." But his aunt told him that even if he hadn't meant any offense, his response was not supportive. Phil came back to my house and apologized. He added that he hoped we could talk about anything, including dating. We hugged, and he said wistfully, "I guess we both need to move on." Others were less accepting. When the press reported that I was seeing someone, one man posted that I was a garbage whore. Another quipped that clearly I was one classy lady because the love of my life died and I was already sharing fluids with a new guy. Fortunately, we can also find understanding on the internet. I read a blog by author Abel Keough about trying to date after his wife died by suicide. He wrote, "The first time I went to dinner with another woman, I felt like I was cheating on my late wife. I was filled with feelings of guilt and betrayal." After 6 months, he met a woman at church. On their first date, he told her he was a widower. She was put off and did not want to see him again. Her father encouraged her to give him a second chance. Less than a year later, they married. They now have 7 children, and Abel has written dating guides for widowers. "There will always be someone who will not understand why you've chosen to date again," he lamented. "They may give you a hard time or have some silly notion that widows and widowers shouldn't fall in love again. Their opinions do not matter. All that matters is that you're ready to date again. You don't need to justify your actions. People who have lost a spouse feel enough grief and guilt on their own. Judging them makes those feelings worse. It's kinder to see dating not as a betrayal, but as an attempt for them to break through the sorrow and find some joy. I'll always be grateful that Paula, Rob, and David raised the subject. They brought up the dating elephant and then escorted it politely out of the room. Still, dating does not erase my grief. All of us in the club understand this. You can miss your spouse and be with someone else, especially if that person is secure enough to let you grieve and help you through it. I had breakfast with a friend 3 months after he lost his wife and said he should start dating when he was ready, hoping to give him the same kind encouragement that Dave's family had given me. Later, he went on his first date and emailed me. It was weird, and I was still just as sad the next day. But as awkward as it was at moments, it felt like one of the first steps forward I have taken. I felt alive again. I met Tracy Robinson this past summer when our kids attended the same camp. Like me, she was a widow with two children. For years, she felt deeply lonely without her husband, Dan. She clung to her friends, becoming closer to some while others let her down. She was not thinking about dating, and then she met Michelle. "There's a kindness in her," she told me. "I love her in a very different way than I loved Dan." Tracy and Michelle married this past summer, 5 years after Dan died. Tracy still misses him and says that getting remarried has not changed that. But she feels strongly about seizing opportunities because life truly can be over in a heartbeat. "I almost hate to say this, but I am the happiest I have ever been in my life," she told me. Sometimes it takes going through something so awful to realize the beauty that is out there in this world. Brain scans of people in love reveal an intoxicating state of energy and euphoria. After we fall in love, we gain confidence and self-esteem and expand our identities. Often we take on some of our new partner's qualities. Falling for someone who is curious or calm can make us see ourselves a bit more that way too. Dating brought humor back into my life. The man I mentioned to Phil began emailing, at first intermittently and then more frequently. And in months and months of notes, he never failed to make me laugh. He called himself the King of Distraction, and he was. He helped me focus more on the present and future and find moments of joy. If love is the third rail of grief, laughter is equally charged. In the face of death, it feels wildly inappropriate to joke about anything. Even worse is joking about death itself. But every so often, I found myself doing it, and was then completely aghast, as if I had caught myself putting my hand and arm into some forbidden cookie jar. The first joke I remember making was when an ex-boyfriend walked into my house after the funeral. He hugged me and said how sorry he was. "This is all your fault," I responded. "If you had been straight, we would have gotten married, and then none of this would have happened." We both laughed. And then I gasped, horrified at myself for making the joke. A few weeks later, my sister-in-law Amy and I were upstairs in my room, crying together. I looked up and said, "Well, at least I don't have to watch his bad movies anymore." We were both stunned into silence. Then we burst into laughter because Dave really did have terrible taste in movies. Almost as bad as my taste in TV shows. I still cringe every time I think of these jokes, but they pushed away the overwhelming darkness of the moment. Later, Rob did the same thing, blurting out that he would never forgive his brother for leaving him with a mother, wife, and sister-in-law who were all calling him 20 times a day. It was funny because it was true. And unfortunately for Rob, I didn't take the hint and call him any less often. The gasping has faded, and now I can make jokes about Dave quite easily, as long as they are the same jokes we made together when he was alive. Jokes about his death, however, are still shockers. But they do help break the tension. One day, a friend of ours who knew that Dave wanted our son to go to private school noted with surprise that he is attending a public middle school. I said, "If Dave wanted our children to go to private school, he should have stuck around to make it happen." Our friend froze for a second, and then relaxed as it dawned on him that I was joking. We then had our first real conversation since Dave died. Humor can make us more resilient. Surgery patients who watch comedies request 25% less pain medication. Soldiers who make jokes deal better with stress. People who laugh naturally 6 months after losing a spouse cope better. Couples who laugh together are more likely to stay married. Physiologically, humor lowers our heart rate and relaxes our muscles. Evolutionarily, humor is a signal that a situation is safe. Laughter breaks tension by making stressful situations less threatening. Humor can also provide a little dash of morality in which wrongs are righted. When you take a horrible situation and add a punchline to it, for at least a moment you have shifted the balance of power. The helpless become the victors, and the underdog gets the last word. Mel Brooks said he made fun of Hitler and the Nazis because, if you can reduce them to ridicule, then you're way ahead. For centuries, jesters were the only people who could speak truth to power and had permission to challenge a king or queen. Today in the United States, late-night TV comedians play this role. Jokes are common at funerals because gallows humor helps us triumph over sadness. Before writing Lean In With Me, Nell Scovell wrote for TV comedies. She has 4 siblings, and when they lost their mom, she opened her eulogy by holding up an envelope and declaring, "I have in this envelope the name of Mom's favorite child." After one of Nell's friends was widowed, she started keeping a journal where she expressed her feelings to her deceased husband and noted, "He's a way better listener now." Comedian Janice Massetti's husband died suddenly 2 weeks after they got married. When she was asked how she lost her husband, she retorted, "He's not lost. He had a great sense of direction. He's dead." Humor can provide relief, even for a split second. Trying to move on, I brought the king of distraction to my cousin's wedding. It was a relief to have someone to dance with again. But being at a family wedding without Dave was still hard. I put on my game face as the music started playing. A woman came over and said, "I heard you were dating. I am so glad you're okay now." Another woman shook hands with my date and then turned to me and exclaimed, "It's so nice to see you're over Dave's death." I know they meant well and wanted me to be happy, but no, I am not over Dave's death. I never will be. When we marry, we promise to love till death do us part. Our images of love are active. We love by being there for a friend, taking care of a child, waking up next to someone. All of which depend upon the person being alive. One of the most important things I've learned is how deeply you can keep loving someone after they die. You may not be able to hold them or talk to them, and you may even date or love someone else, but you can still love them every bit as much. Playwright Robert Woodruff Anderson captured it perfectly. Death ends a life, but it does not end a relationship. Last summer, I had dinner with 3 couples who are all close friends of mine, but were just getting to know one another. They went around the table sharing their stories of how they met. Spouses interjecting the funniest sides of a well-honed routine. As the conversation began, I got that feeling in the pit of my stomach. And as the conversation continued, that feeling grew and grew. "Elephant, I never thought I'd miss you." At first, I thought I was sad because it was insensitive of my friends to tell their love stories with me sitting right there. It had been 15 months and 3 days since Dave's death. And for most people, it was no longer at the forefront of their minds. The world had moved on. I went home early that night, explaining that I didn't feel well. But the next morning, I woke up even more upset, not at my friends, who would never want to hurt me, but at the realization that no one would ever ask me again how Dave and I met. As the couples went around the table, they had skipped me. Now that Dave was gone, our cute how we met story was no longer cute. Asking people how they met their deceased partner seems cruel, so no one does it. But for the widow or widower, not asking means they miss out on the nostalgia of recalling those early romantic days. I called Tracy Robinson, and we agreed that from now on, we would both ask the members of our club how they met their partner to give them a chance to remember the excitement of that first encounter. As Adam and I studied resilience at home and at work, we also thought about how to apply these lessons to relationships. We all want to forge bonds that can withstand stress, make both people stronger, and get us through life's ups and downs. In a new romance, it often seems easy. Psychologists find that when people are falling in love, even arguments make them more attracted to each other. Ever heard of makeup sex? Then people move out of the honeymoon phase, and just dealing with the ordinary hassles of life can create strain. Sometimes adversity strikes without warning. A partner gets sick, or laid off, or depressed. Other times adversity stems from a mistake or bad choice. A partner cheats, or lies, or becomes unkind or abusive. Try as we might, sometimes relationships don't or shouldn't last. To build resilience in a loving, long-term relationship, we need to pay attention to the everyday interactions we have with our partners. In a well-known study, 130 newlyweds were invited to spend the day at the Love Lab, which resembled a bed and breakfast. The psychologists observed the couples interacting in the wild and made predictions about which marriages would last. They were able to predict divorce over the next 6 years with 83% accuracy. A key was buried in the couple's conversations, which often started with bids for attention, affection, support, or laughter. We are making a bid whenever we say things like, "Hey, look at that bird," or "Are we out of butter?" When a partner makes a bid, the other partner has two choices, to turn away or turn toward. Turning away means dismissing or ignoring the bid. "Stop talking about birds. I'm watching TV." Turning toward means engaging. "Yep, I'll go get some butter and some popcorn to go with it." The newlyweds who stayed together over the next 6 years turned toward each other 86% of the time, while couples who got divorced turned toward each other only 33%. Most of the couple's fights weren't about money or sex, but about failed bids for connection. Adam's colleague Jane Dutton defines a resilient relationship as one that has the capacity to carry intense emotions and withstand strain. It's more than two resilient individuals connecting. Resilience becomes a feature of the connection itself. My late friend Harriet Breaker was a therapist who published many books on love. She often said there were three parties in any relationship: you, the other person, and the relationship itself. The relationship is a meaningful entity that needs to be protected and nurtured. Part of protecting and nurturing a bond is doing small things together. After falling in love, couples often find that the sparks fade, and one way to reignite them is to try new or exciting activities. I remember going to an out-of-town wedding where Dave and I spent most of the weekend playing Scrabble. A friend who was recently divorced watched us and remarked that he and his ex-wife never really did anything together, and that his new goal was to find someone who would play Scrabble with them. Apparently, Scrabble was his idea of an exciting experience. Mine too. For a relationship to last, partners have to be able to deal with conflict. When newlyweds were asked to talk for 15 minutes about an ongoing disagreement in their marriage, the amount of anger expressed by a husband or wife had no bearing on whether the couple got divorced over the next 6 years. The most common pattern for couples that divorced went like this. the wife would bring up an issue. The husband would get belligerent or defensive, and then the wife would reciprocate with sadness, disgust, or stonewalling. In the couples whose marriages lasted, instead of escalating negativity, both partners showed humor and affection. They took responsibility for their problems and found ways to compromise. They sent signals that even though they were fighting, at a deeper level, they were okay. When we argue with our partners, it's easy to get stuck in our own point of view. Taking a broader perspective helps resolve conflict. In one study, couples were instructed to write about their biggest disagreement as if they were outsiders looking in on the fight. Just 3 journal entries of 7 minutes each were enough to help the couples maintain a loving marriage over the next year. Of course, a strong relationship doesn't solve all problems. My friend Jennifer Jaffe loves her husband and he loves her. They have 2 great kids. Jennifer is one of the kindest people I know. But for 35 years, she was not kind to herself. I disliked myself so much, hated myself truthfully, that I had no regard for my body, she said. Jennifer's father died when she was the same age as my daughter, and that profound sadness triggered decades of compulsive eating. I used food to medicate the pain of losing my dad, she said. But as I got older, I also used it to keep a protective layer between me and the world. Then a few years ago, Jennifer's daughter was riding her bike home from school and got hit by a car. She was released from the hospital later that day, but this near catastrophe jolted Jennifer's perspective. When my biggest fear almost came true, I realized I was not really living my life, she said. She was able to stop her compulsive eating for a while, but by spring, she was binging again. Then Dave died. Jennifer came over right away to comfort us. And in a beautiful twist, helping us turned out to help her, too. Just watching it all again was like being a ghost from Christmas past, she told me. I looked at your daughter and wanted her to know her world had changed forever, and it was so unfair, but it wasn't her fault. It wasn't anyone's fault. It was just life. I wanted her to love herself, and I wanted my daughter to love herself. But how could I expect her and my son to do that when their own mother did not? At last, Jennifer started treating herself with the kindness and care she showed others. Her big breakthrough came when she realized, you cannot outrun any addiction. You must heal, and that takes a kind of love that no one else can provide for you. Once Jennifer found self-compassion and self-acceptance, she was able to gain control over her addiction and now coaches other women who struggle with emotional eating. She is a role model for me and a reminder that the love we need to lead a fulfilling life cannot only come from others, but must come from inside us as well. Like so much else in life, finding someone to love is not something we can control. As my Facebook colleague Nina Chowdhury got older, she grappled with her lifelong desire to get married and have children. Her parents had an arranged marriage, fell deeply in love, and then her father passed away when she was 3. The only reality I have known is growing up with a single mother who was not one by choice. That was her option B, Nina says. Nina dreamed of getting married and starting a family. Her mother encouraged her to look for the right partner and marry for love. Nina started searching for the perfect man. In her 20s, she would go on a first date and immediately ask herself, is this someone I could marry? Nina remained optimistic, but as more and more online matches and blind dates didn't pan out, she began to wonder if the dream she shared with her mother might not come true. As Nina approached 40, she realized that she couldn't control whether she fell in love, but she could choose to have a child. She was worried about the risks of pregnancy, so she started thinking about adoption. At 43, I had this aha moment of acceptance in realizing life is not about image. It's about fulfillment, she said.